So I've come to talk to you this morning under the title, So I Married an Evangelist. And I think I said earlier, I didn't choose that title. It might be Roger, I'm not sure. But many of you, you are evangelists. And so you might think, hang on, I didn't marry an evangelist. I am an evangelist. So what's this got to do with me? But hopefully, as we look at these historic marriages, you will see not only that you've got lessons to learn if you're married yourself, if you're not married, how to support those you work alongside or know who are married. Marriage really under threat, isn't it, at the moment? And strong marriages are vital. And in ministry, I know some of us might have struggled in marriage, have difficult marriages, might even have marriages that haven't worked out. And we need to remember, don't we, the forgiveness and the grace of the Lord Jesus. But for those who are married, we need to be thinking, how can those be strengthened through Christ and his strengthening? So, there we go. First of all, I'd like you just to have a think with your neighbour about what do you consider the best and hardest things about being an evangelist? So the best things and the hardest things. You've got literally 2 minutes. Okay, you could be here all day, I know. You've probably been discussing this all week. But do just a couple of things. Just talk to your neighbour. The best and the worst things about being an evangelist. I said 2 minutes, and I think that is probably 2 minutes. Slightly different tack. Now, if you are married, discuss what you think might be the best and hardest things about being married to you, particularly as an evangelist. And if you're not married, what would you say to that question, looking in at the marriages of others that you know of? So what do you think is, what's going to make it hard and good being married to you as an evangelist? So not just to you, because I think we can all examine all our sins and think it's going to be really hard being married to me, but as an evangelist, in the role that you have, what's going to make it hard and good to be married to you? 2 minutes. Right, your time is up. Now, as we look at these two marriages that we're going to be looking at, the marriages of Molly and John Wesley and Emma and D.L. Moody, I think we'll see that obviously they lived in very different times. The Wesleys during the 18th century, the Moody's during the 19th century, and times have changed. But actually some of the stresses and strains, as well as joys and privileges of being an evangelist, are remarkably similar. And I think we have still got lessons to learn. Like I said, when we look at Molly and John, hopefully they're lessons on how not to, whereas DL and Emma are going to be lessons on how to. And just interesting, she called him DL his entire life. So it's interesting, isn't it? So, first of all, again, what we're going to have to think about is the world of the Wesleys. Now, I used to be a history teacher. Okay, I love history. I'm aware some of you might have... I didn't like history at school, but I liked it later. So don't think, oh, history, that's really boring. But we're just going to have a think a little bit of the world of the Wesleys to start with, to see how far it was different to our own world, how far those challenges of being an evangelist might be the same and how different. Okay, so this is kind of a little quiz. I'm not going to be marking it. I might have been a teacher, but there's no red pen involved this time. So again, I'm going to read these out and then talk to your neighbours and see if you can come up with the answers. Which of these modes of transport were available to John Wesley? Car, train, boat, foot, horse, carriage. Okay, I'm guessing when you talked about the difficulties of being an evangelist, travel and being, you know, having to travel a lot was probably one of them. Obviously, John Wesley was no different. He had to travel. So, hands up. Actually, this is nearly as bad as a red pen, isn't it, actually? Hands up who think he might have travelled by car. There's always one, isn't there? It was a car crash marriage. That's very true. Yeah. Very, very, very good. Unfortunately, no cars available. Train? No. He trained others, but no trains. Trains were, you know, getting on for, you know, 1830s were the first trains, really. A lot long after. Boats? Yeah. He did travel. He went to Ireland quite a bit. He went to this, to America. Foot? Yeah, quite a lot. Horse? Yeah. Carriage? Available, but he didn't often use it, and we'll see why. He was usually on horse. It was cheaper. It was quicker. So which of these ways of communicating with family were available to John Wesley? Telegram? Nope. Letter? Yep. Email? No. Face-to-face communication? When he was actually there. So it's only letters. Actually, letters probably took no longer than they do now, which is interesting, isn't it? There was no proper postal service, but if you got one of the postboys to deliver it, it could be there in a couple of days. So it wasn't as bad. It depends where you were, but it was letters. No phone, no email. It was not instantaneous at all. It's very small on my screen. How much did John Wesley earn once his ministry was established? The equivalent of £450,000 a year, the equivalent of 80,000, or the equivalent of 30,000. Now, I'm guessing one of the other challenges of being an evangelist is finance. You know, it's hard, isn't it? Hands up for 450,000. Well, it wasn't a salary, but earned. Yeah, equivalent of. No. Annually. 80,000? 30,000? He actually earned, as in donations, 450,000. He then gave it all away. We see that became an issue in his marriage, actually, because he knew he could live quite adequately on 30,000, the equivalent of £27 a year, that was. And he just gave any excess away. But sort of so straitened circumstances he chose for himself. Which of these were common motives for marriage in the 18th century? Love. To provide children, arranged by families for financial or social advantage, or to provide a co-worker. So, love? Produce children? Yeah. Arranged by families? Yeah. Financial advantage and social advantage? Yep. Provide a co-worker. Interestingly, love was on the rise, and this again is a bit of a problem for the Wesleys. So 18th century is all becoming kind of romantic poets and all this kind of thing, and romance was a thing. And so all the other things were true, but love was becoming a bit more of an issue for people. So as we shall see, marriage was very different in some ways, but it was changing to be a bit more similar to the motives which we might see today. So here we have John and Molly Wesley. So they did have to cope with, as we've seen, poor communication, a lot of time that John was on the road, limited finances, and this kind of complicated, what is marriage? What is love? What should we expect? And I've called John and Molly Wesley a cautionary tale, a reckless, I shouldn't have chosen this, I can't say my R's very well, a reckless rebound romance. So I don't know how much you know about the Wesleys, but obviously they were converted, having been as missionaries to Georgia in America, and had a totally hopeless time, really. Met some Moravian Christians on the boat home, went to a Moravian meeting, heard the gospel explained from Luther's commentary on Romans, and were both, over a very short amount of time, wonderfully converted. And they realised that they were living in a world where most people hadn't heard the gospel and needed to know. And so George Whitfield originally started outdoor preaching, and he persuaded his friend, he knew from Oxford, he persuaded the Wesleys to go alongside them and to preach outdoors, which was really hard. They were shut out of churches, they were pelted with rotten vegetables, they were stoned, and it was pretty grim. And they decided, John and Charles, they'd made a pact never to marry. They decided that being itinerant evangelists with uncertain finances and initially with risks to their life, being away all the time, that they should not marry. And then Charles fell in love. And John said, that's not fair. We promised we weren't going to get married. And so John had his eye on a church worker up in Newcastle. He thought she'll do perfectly. He was fond of her. And then she went and married someone else. So, oh, no, what do? I want to get married now. Anyway, he slipped on ice in London and had to be looked after by a wealthy widow in the congregation. And her name was Molly Vassale. She came from a church-going Christian family. And within a week, pretty much, they were married. He thought, well, she's fine. She's a widow and she's got children. They were by then 40-plus, not going to have any more children. Great. No more distractions. Her previous husband was a merchant. He was away a lot. She knows what she's getting into. And she's a member of the church. It's going to be fine, isn't it? So he was 48. She was 40. They weren't kids. They should have known what they were getting into and sensibly considered things. But it didn't work out. I mean, he thought actually she could be very useful, this whole co-worker idea. She'd done her husband's books before. She could be the bookkeeper as the ministry developed. She would have a role as being the treasurer and the bookkeeper. Anyway, as we shall see, it didn't work out. Very soon after, he doesn't actually mention his marriage in his diaries at all. Doesn't mention that he got married, which is a bit odd, isn't it, really? And he wrote this very soon after. He said, I cannot understand how a Methodist preacher can answer it to God to preach one sermon or travel one day less in a married than in a single state. So obviously he was taking, you know, 1 Corinthians 7 very seriously, live as if you had no wife. And that's what he was doing. So Molly, unsurprisingly, was she saw things differently. Her expectations were quite different. She had married John Wesley. He was up-and-coming, famous guy. You know, he was, okay, might have been, you know, pelted by tomatoes, but actually, in the church in London, he was the kingpin. He was the head of the new, they weren't necessarily called Methodists by then, but he was this head of this new movement. He was the guy, if you were going to get married. So she expected status. She knew that money was coming in. So she expected to be able to maintain the lifestyle she'd had with her merchant previous husband. And she'd only ever seen him in London. So she hadn't seen what he went through when he was out on the roads and didn't really understand his ministry at all. And I think she was unaware. She might have been unaware of all the money that came in. She was unaware of the fact that it just went straight out again and that he gave it away. So she was setting herself up for disappointment, but they made assumptions about their marriage and they hadn't actually really talked about it. They barely knew each other when they got married. She was just a member of the congregation. He'd convalesced for a week in her home. So not surprisingly, wrong expectations led very swiftly to disappointment. Now, one of the challenges I'm sure came up in your conversations of being an evangelist is travelling and time away from family. And initially, Molly said, yeah, I'm all in. I'm coming too. And as I said, there was the option of a carriage, but John said, no, carriages cost money. We want to save money. And horses, you can travel faster. So we're going on horseback. So this horseback, before decent roads, okay, it was before even most of the turnpike roads had been built. You are talking ditches and floods and just dreadful. Talking highwaymen. Charles Wesley was certainly accosted by a highwayman. I think John was as well. It was dangerous. You didn't even have a proper Mac. You know, you were drenched through often. It was all weathers. And so she was actually, not surprisingly, fairly appalled. Also, wherever they went to the cheapest lodgings or were put up by church members. And it wasn't very nice. And so she complained and she didn't enjoy it at all. And very soon she demanded a carriage. If she was going to come with him, she had to go in a carriage. She was not going on horseback anymore. But even the carriage was not safe. People spotted John Wesley and would chuck vegetables through the window and stones and stone them. It was grim. So not surprisingly, she stopped travelling with him. He was quite relieved because all she did was moan. But on the other hand, are you surprised? I mean, it sounds quite grim. So she stayed at home. I think it's quite impressive that a woman in her 40s actually travelled with him at all in those conditions. She had some children at home and she travelled on her own with John Wesley. I think it would have been quite hard. One of the times they did travel together, said she's barely mentioned in his journals, which says quite a lot. But she was there when they nearly drowned. And one time they arrived in lodgings at 1 a.m. because the travel had been so bad. And it said this, 1 a.m. arrived due to poor weather, left 2 hours later, and John said, feeling greatly refreshed. You know, I doubt she was feeling greatly refreshed, but on she went, on for another thing. And when her young son was dying in London, she was expected to return alone. And thankfully, she got there in time to be with her husband, her child as he died. But he didn't consider, again, barely mentioned in his diaries. He just expected her to go back and be with her dying son and then to just carry on as normal. He expected a Wonder Woman with the same capacity for hard work and for hardship as him. And he was wrong. And she expected a companion, a father for her children, and status. And she was wrong. So it's just really sad. So soon, Molly stopped travelling with John. And at home, she was quite useful because she did do the books. And he said, in order to the publishing business, him and John published his hymns. He published theological works and so on. So you are allowed to open all my post when it comes in. It's a bit like sort of saying to your other half, OK, you can check all my emails. That's fine. Also a huge risk because he was very unaffectionate towards Molly. But like I said, this is a time of sort of romantic love all becoming a thing. He had quite a few kind of romantic friendships with other women. Now, that at best is very unwise. He wrote far more affectionate letters to these other women than he ever did to Molly. And Molly opened those letters. Now, there's been a lot of debate. Did he ever have an affair? Almost certainly not. I mean, I think it was just a thing where you wrote kind of flowery stuff to other people. But it was deeply hurtful for her, as it would be. I mean, I think we can all imagine if you found an email from, you know, somebody else to your spouse. And rather than kind of respond and talk to him, obviously letters were few and far between. He wasn't often home. So they weren't able to actually talk it through. And she became increasingly bitter. She actually offered to sell those letters. You might know there was a kind of disagreement between the more Calvinistic and the more Armenian Methodists, so Whitfield's lot and Wesley's lot. She offered to sell them, or give them even, to the Whitfield gang to publish, to destroy her husband's reputation. Great. Thankfully, they refused. They said, no, we're not even going there. But that's how bitter she became. Rather than talking to him in a nice way, apparently she was seen by somebody else in the room, dragging John around the room by his rather sparse hair. So, you know, this is bad, isn't it? One time, apparently, Charles said he just read John's gospel in Greek because she was just having a go at them and just haranguing them. And the only way he could kind of just filter that out was going through John's gospel in Greek. So she was not obviously an easy lady, but I think... Nor was John a good husband. You know, you've got her distrust and then disloyalty. She felt disloyalty from him, being affectionate toward these other women. And then she was disloyal to him by offering to sell these letters to the press. So it's a disaster. And she wanted to damage his reputation. Now, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, nowadays, what would happen in a toxic marriage like that in Christian circles? You know, Twitter would have a field day, wouldn't it? It would be absolutely disastrous. He once wrote to her, he said, "Know me and know yourself. Suspect me no more, asperse me no more, provoke me no more. Do not any longer contend for mastery." And this is really tragic. "Be content to be a private, insignificant person known and loved by God and me. I don't try and be above yourself." And Robert Southey, who was one of the romantic poets, he wrote a biography of Wesley, and he quotes the rest of that letter, which is awful. He reminded her that she had laid to his charge things that he knew not, robbed him, betrayed his confidence, revealed his secrets, given him 1,000 treacherous wounds, and made it her business to do so. under the pretense of vindicating her own character. Whereas, so if you think it's all on her side, whereas, said he, of what importance is your character to mankind? If you were buried just now, or if you'd never lived, what loss would it be to the cause of God? I mean, that's horrifying, isn't it? I mean, it's absolutely horrifying. So it's both of them. You know, it is just, as in a car crash. She left him several times. He begged her to return, but finally she left for good. And after 20 years of marriage, and in fact, he only heard she died kind of in the papers. But it's an absolute tragedy. But I think there are lessons that we can learn, and I've just sort of jotted them down rather than discussing them. You know, in 1 Corinthians 7, it does value singleness. And I think that's where he was coming from. I'm in this ministry, I should be single. But then he got married. And priorities change. You know, Ephesians 5, 1 Peter 3, verse 7, you know, marriage matters to God. And I think the danger is he just thought my ministry is what matters. And therefore, my wife does not matter. She only matters in as far as she contributes to my ministry. So he neglected her. He criticized her. I mean, she was not easy. But on the other hand, he was not a good husband. And I think, you know, just be aware of that. If you are married, if you're not married, think and pray long and hard. I'm sure people do, about whether to marry or not. But if you are married, your marriage matters. Next little obvious point, don't marry someone you've only known for a week. I mean, you know, I think, but also we all make assumptions coming into marriages, and I think talk about it. And even if you've been married a long time, still talk about those assumptions you make about the other one, what you expect of them. Make sure you're talking and communicating. And ask the question, what is it like to be married to me? I read a very good book about that. And I thought, we always think, if only he or if only she. But actually, what's it like to be married to me? What's going to make it hard for them to be married to me, particularly as an evangelist? How can I talk to them more about that? Is there anything I can do to make it easier or to help them to understand? And it might be maybe if they saw you at work more, or but with Molly, that was the opposite, you know, but actually encourage and help. And I think there are particular trials and temptations in the marriage of an itinerant evangelist particularly. Resist them. Be aware of those temptations. As Rico reminded us, you know, be aware of our own depravity. What are those temptations? There will be time away from your spouse. You know, be aware of the temptations that might bring. With John Wesley, it did give him the opportunity to develop romantic relationships with other women. That's not good. You know, it's not saying the Billy Graham rule, but, you know, be aware of the temptations and be aware about how that might, you know, time away might affect your husband or wife. My husband was an airline pilot when I first met him, and I was just very aware, it was before mobiles and stuff, that he was away, and I just assumed there were all these really glamorous stewardesses. And then he said, they're the same age as your mum. He did short haul, all the ones who wanted to get back for bath time. So I met some of them, and it just put my mind at rest. But it was hard. He was a young guy in his 20s. We just got married. And in my head, there were all these incredibly glamorous stewardesses. But maybe it is. That's what you're, you know, if you talk about people you work with who are men or women, just introduce them, make them, you know, help them to know, reduce their fears, and it can help. Don't believe the hype. I think, you know, that awful quote, John Wesley saying that, you know, what use are you to God's cause, obviously meant he thought he was very important to God's cause. And I think in your roles, it's easy for either you, as Rico said again, you know, pride, a real temptation. It's easy, isn't it? Other people put you on a pedestal, particularly if you are going into other churches and running a mission. Wow, they're great. Don't believe the hype. You're just a sinner saved by grace. And you need to remember that. Be humble and be prepared to, you know, to work with your other half on that. So there's a few kind of negatives on the Wesleys, and it's just a cautionary tale. But thankfully, we do have an exemplary tale, which is D.L. and Emma Moody, a tale of Christ-like compatibility. And hopefully more of this will resonate with us in our marriages, or maybe think, okay, I could tweak that. It wasn't perfect. They were still sinners, but it was a lovely marriage. So on paper, the Wesleys' marriage could have worked. That's what they thought coming to it. Oh, yeah, we've got things in common. We're similar age. This is all going to work. But actually, with the Moody's, it looked unlikely on paper to be a good marriage. They came from very, very different backgrounds. So D.L. Moody, you might know, he was a guy from the backwoods. He was, brought up by, very poor family. He came to Chicago to work in his uncle's shoe shop and became a shoe salesman. I think he sounds like a member of the Carswell family, just brilliant salespeople, and thankfully they're selling Jesus. But I think it's the same with D.L. Moody. He was a fantastic salesman, but he was poorly educated. He had no social graces. He was just a backward boy. Whereas Emma, her family had moved to America because financial problems, they'd moved. They'd left one child behind. One of her sisters just left behind. Extraordinary, but anyway. But the rest of them came to America just for a better life. But they were much more middle class. They were much more educated. They were much more refined. And they didn't look as though they were going to be a great match, but they really were. When they met, she was a quiet 15-year-old girl from this refined English family. And he was a 21-year-old who was just beginning to drag himself out of that poverty that he'd been born into. And she came from a keen Christian family. He came from a Unitarian family, but had become a Christian through his uncle and became Baptist. But she was from a Baptist family. And he had been fairly recently converted. She was solid Christian home. And soon he realised that he could use these salesman skills for the gospel. So what he'd started doing was going round the kind of streets to the rough kids in Chicago, gathering them up and teaching them the gospel. And the ministry grew and grew and grew and grew. And he thought, okay, I need workers. So he asked for help to work with these kids. And Emma joined the team. So she was just 15. And he immediately kind of thought, she's nice, but she's only 15. So they had to wait a couple of years. And her parents initially were quite keen because he was doing really well. He was earning a lot of money. But soon after that, so a bit like Molly Wesley thinking she was marrying a wealthy man, Emma would have thought she was marrying a wealthy man, but he gave up his business and did everything for the gospel, gave up everything. So he didn't have a regular income at all at that stage. But I think the difference is they, unlike the Wesleys, they met serving the gospel. They both had a heart for evangelism. They both had a heart for the lost. And that was maintained throughout their marriage. It was wonderful. So that Emma, once he gave up his business, she said, okay, I'm going to have to become a school teacher. She was from the kind of world where you didn't do that. If you're a married woman, you stayed at home and you did crochet or whatever. But they needed money, so she went out to work as a school teacher. And so they always had a passion for gospel ministry, and she was prepared to do what it took to enable him to do that. So not easy. And so that taking the job was not... So they had a life of compromise. Ooh, there you go. Compromise, which, again, the Wesleys absolutely were not prepared to do. They were not prepared to compromise. Both of them had to have it their way. Whereas... So Emma taking the job was not the first compromise she made. It was also not all one-sided. So I think this is a brilliant little example, really. He was a fantastic communicator. And he was preaching more and more and more. But his sermons were very much kind of hellfire. I know we've been encouraged to speak on hell, but that was pretty much it with him. God's love was kind of second to hellfire. And Emma had heard the preaching of
Henry Morehouse,
thank you, an English preacher in the States. I said, he's talking from John 3:16 about God's great love for the world. I think you should do that. I think you should preach about God's love. And he did. Isn't that great? You know, he's already kind of getting to be the great D.L. Moody, but he listened to what his wife said. And it's always a good idea. But joking aside, actually the humility, and again what Wiko was saying, the humility to be willing to learn from his young wife, I think is just wonderful. You know, this was 150 years ago, and he was a working class lad. You know, I think that's even more extraordinary, isn't it? In a very misogynistic, very patriarchal kind of society, where in a normal world she'd have just been sitting at home doing the crochet, and actually he's accepting kind of ideas from her. Now, the obvious thing to do, in a way, having built up this successful, which eventually became Moody Church, successful work amongst the young hoodlums in Chicago, the obvious thing would have been to stay and to build on that work and to build it up. But again, it was almost Emma and DL's concern for Emma that built his evangelistic ministry worldwide. So her father had died. There'd been a fire and their house had been burnt down. There's another fire when the house was burnt down again. This is the first time. And she'd had a very difficult birth of her daughter. And DL thought, actually, Emma needs a break. So they went back to Britain to visit her sister, who had always stayed behind, and the rest of the family in the UK. And the contacts he made there basically built the basis of his ministry and his evangelistic crusades in Britain, which eventually, as we know, reached thousands and thousands and thousands. And the differences between them in personality and background that could have caused real problems, and with the Wesleys really did cause problems, actually were wonderfully complementarian, not in a kind of theological sense, but just in a marriage sense. They worked really well together as a team. And they respected the different qualities they each brought to the marriage. So DL was obviously the preacher. He was the guy who got up in front and he preached brilliantly. But he always acknowledged that Emma was a much better one-to-one worker. So when people went for prayer after the Crusades, he always knew if there's a particularly tricky case, he would send them to Emma. And Emma could always push them over the line and get them into the kingdom. She was brilliant at explaining people gently and kindly what it meant and what it looked like to be a Christian. Also, he might have been a great speaker, but his writing and spelling was pretty atrocious. And she did all his correspondence. And I think maybe if he had written it, he wouldn't have got so many invitations, because he thought, hang on, this guy can't write at all. He's going to be a rubbish speaker. But no, she wrote all his correspondence. And also she smoothed the way in social situations. As he got more and more famous, he was invited to meet, you know, lords and ladies when he was in the UK, and he met the president. I mean, he was the kind of guy who really would not know which knife and fork to use. And in those days, that really mattered. So she would kind of smooth it over and help him. The great thing was, initially, a lot of his ministry was in the UK, and they just thought he was American. So they forgave him everything. Americans don't know how to use knife and forks. They still don't know how to use knife and forks. And they just thought, he's American, so we forgive him. Whereas in the States, interestingly, it was a bit more of an issue. They expected him to know how to behave, and he never did. But despite their teamwork, there were challenges. I mean, many of those challenges did come from him being an evangelist. It was really hard. But some of the challenges were just horrendous. I mean, the Great Chicago Fire left 100,000 people homeless. It was obviously a new city anyway, because the West was only just being won. And largely wooden buildings. And 100,000 people were left homeless, including the Moodys. And they'd only just had this wonderful new house built for them by supporters. Their initial house had been burnt down in another fire. When you think you just got lots of kind of gaslighting and wood fires and wooden buildings, fire was a real problem. Interestingly, they collected almost nothing from their house. They went Emma insisted on retrieving a portrait of DL, which he was mortified by. He thought this was just, no, that's not the one thing you keep. And a little toy stove, cast iron stove, which was the only thing that had survived the fire from one of the children. So they decided to move. During the fire, interestingly, they went to stay with the Spufford family, who he had written, It Is Well With My Soul, following the death of his family. So I guess this must have been before that. But, you know, tragedies abound, don't they, in this generation of people. So they decided to relocate. A bit odd in that the focus of their mission and the church was in Chicago, but they decided to move to rural Massachusetts, where he had been brought up, close to his family. So that's fine, and then it was close to his family. It was 1,000 miles from hers, and she was actually very close to her family. He was less close to his. They were all Unitarians, and so really suspicious. It was a big Unitarian area, very suspicious of this Baptist family coming in and trying to stir things up. So they were really viewed with suspicion there. So quite lonely, a long way from home. She was up for it. And I think she must have known what she was looking for. She never complained about it, but hard. I never quite got to the bottom of that decision, but there you go. And there were also challenges in... where's it gone? Because he became more and more famous. They had to kind of... She had a family, had children. So obviously she couldn't travel with him in quite the same way as she could before. And it was really challenging. But initially, the first big evangelistic crusade he went on was to the UK. And the reason they went was to try and raise funds to rebuild Chicago and the church in Chicago. And they thought, actually, all these quite wealthy people we've met, they might be able to help. But obviously, he was absolutely brilliant. And the family came, but whereas before she'd been involved in the inquirer's room, talking to people about Christ, encouraging him and them, increasingly she had to stay at home and to look after the children. And also, again, slightly heartbreaking and maybe not the best thing to say, the meetings were so full. Thousands and thousands of people were coming. He said, we need every seat. Please don't come. So she didn't even come to see the meetings. Oh, that's hard, isn't it? And when they finally returned to the States, he was a celebrity. He was huge. And that meant loads of people wanted to come and visit in Massachusetts. And she was expected to be the hostess. Thankfully, that is what she'd been brought up to. Okay, she was only 17 when she got married, but she was expected to look after all these people who came to stay. I can't remember who it was once, but I think it was some ambassador said he was coming with a retinue of 70. And she said, no, they can go to a hotel, which I think is probably fair enough. But, you know, she was expected to have people over. And increasingly, as time went on, she always preferred a quiet life. And she did realise she was going to have to focus on her own ministry at home because he was away so often. So she got very involved in the Sunday school. They set up a boys and a girls school in Massachusetts. And she was very involved with particularly the girls school, but both of them. She'd invite children over for tea so they could have a sort of family home at the boarding school, have a family experience and looked after them. So she wasn't bored when he was away. But DL worked insanely hard. I mean, it was just really, really difficult. In 1891, when he was in the UK, he visited a doctor. When he was in the UK in 1891, he went to Scotland and he visited 99 places in 90 days, preaching 4 times a day. Now, I know you guys work really hard, but I think even Roger, that probably not quite there. So I think, you know, and he visited a doctor while just after that. And he said, you are a fool, sir. You are killing yourself. So again, as a wife, it must be really hard. As far as we know, she never complained about his schedule or the strain on his health. Maybe he should have done because he died at 62, having preached, you know, to hundreds of thousands of people. But it was really, really hard. And she really struggled with the kind of public side of his ministry. again, you know, some of you might have a kind of a public face. And I guess to a certain extent, if you're evangelist, you're going to be an extrovert. Maybe not. Not all are. But she was an introvert. And she struggled with that kind of side of things, the public side of things. And even when they went on holiday, they were in the UK one time, often invited round to dukes and duchesses, to castles for dinner, where she was using her social skills over time to try and make sure he didn't, you know, drink his soup out the bowl or whatever it might be. But they were persuaded to go on holiday together and to go to the Holy Land. He'd never been. Via Egypt, and he was persuaded to take a little bit of time out, and in Egypt he was recognized. And this was before even, you know, anything. Nowadays you recognize lots of people because you've seen them on Facebook or you've seen them on TV. In those days it was pretty rare, but he was that famous at that time, and it was a real struggle. But she always supported him in whatever way she was required to do, and he always looked after her. And I think the thing is, they talked about the challenges and strains of their ministry. When they were at home, they talked, they wrote, they discussed. She understood that hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people were going to hear the gospel through him. And she was prepared to let him go for that. Now, that is a hard thing for a spouse to do. And I think that's one of the recognitions, isn't it? Not just Wesley just assumed that she would get it. And never explained it to her and never encouraged her. Whereas Emma got it. And I think if you're married, just encourage your other half to get it, to get that ministry you're involved in and to really engage with it. Sometimes that's going to be hard, isn't it? You know, there are health issues. Later in life, her health declined. She couldn't travel in the same way with him as she'd like to have done. And she missed him desperately, but she couldn't. Susie Spurgeon, you might have heard of, again, her health was very poor. And so she supported him in every way and prayed for him. She couldn't travel with him. That's often an issue, isn't it? Sometimes it is family constraints. You know, she had traveled everywhere with him, but eventually she had to look after young children at home. And that has to be done. And to support and encourage, if it is your wife, sometimes it's going to be your husband who's supporting you as an evangelist. But, you know, realise that can be quite stressful for them, and encourage them and do what you can for that. And eventually, after his death, he was only 62. She was 5 years younger. More than that, 6 years younger. But always looked a lot older than that. Everybody said she kind of aged phenomenally and didn't live that much longer, and her health deteriorated quite fast. But all her children, they're all called Emma. Every generation and every family seemed to have an Emma, because she was amazing and they loved her. And loads of Emmas in the family. I think the very first picture, if I can get, was D.L., Emma and their grandchildren. And family was very important to them. And the kids grew, and I know there's not guaranteed, this is all down to God's grace, not to parenting slot machine, but their children did grow up to be Christians and to have evangelistic hearts. And I think the fact that, you know, both of them shared this vision and spoke well of each other, encouraged each other, I think really helped that, which is great. So, final kind of question for you, which is a kind of a bigger one, and this is there are no answers actually. So just to read 1 Corinthians 7 9 to 31, which was very much Wesley's take on things. I'll read it out. So 7:29-31. What I mean, brothers and sisters, is that the time is short. From now on, those who have wives should live as if they do not. Those who mourn as if they did not. Those who are happy as if they were not. Those who buy something as if they were not theirs to keep. Those who use the things of the world as if not engrossed in them. For this world is, in its present form, is passing away. And that was very much where John Wesley was coming from. It's in the Bible. But then, obviously, you've got Ephesians 5. 25 to 28. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In the same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. So you've got two very different passages, both by Paul. So I think it's hard, isn't it? You are doing something amazing. You're evangelists. It really matters. But you're also married, if you are married. And marriage matters to God. It's a picture of Christ's love for his church. So, again, it's kind of, we will talk about with neighbours, but also to take away and think and pray through as you go. And if you are married, how can you ensure that your marriage is more like the Moody's than the Wesley's? If you think, oh, gosh, it's not great, you know, just take time to pray. It matters. Your marriage matters. If you're not married, how can you better encourage your married friends? When my husband was at theological college, a non-married guy was encouraging him to read more one-to-one with people, which is a great thing to do. And he said, I think I need to spend some time with the family. And he said, you should have thought of that before you got married, which wasn't great because he was married. This guy then got married and apologised to my husband. But I think if you're not married, it's very easy to think, come on, guys, you know, you should be doing more. Maybe you should. But actually, if you're married, God values marriage. He values your family. And never forget that. Sometimes it's as simple as you know, always having your screensaver as your wife or your husband. Men, I think now it's very common, wear a wedding ring. You know, never forget you are a married man or a married woman. So just spend a few moments praying, talking to your neighbour. You might want to just sit and think about this on your own. It might not be something you think would be helpful to share. But just a few moments, either chatting, if you think that would be helpful, or sitting quietly. And then I think after that we will go into a time of a prayer together, just in twos and threes. And then if there are any questions, you can ask them. Great. So just have a look at those questions for a few minutes. So if you draw your prayers to a close. And keep praying. Keep praying for each other. Keep praying for others here. Every marriage is different, and every marriage has its own strains and struggles and joys. So don't, if you're single, keep praying for your married friends. I think sometimes it looks easier from the outside. So keep praying. I think we've got just a couple of minutes for questions. If anybody...